Hey everyone, welcome to episode 4 of the Design Details Podcast. I'm Brian Lovin.
And I'm Bryn Jackson. This week we sat down with Christy Tillman. She's a really great designer. I was lucky enough to meet her when she started using a tool I built a long time ago, and we just kind of kept up. And now she's leading design at Society of Grownups in Boston. She's a really cool startup focused on spreading financial literacy. She's also a co-founder of the Detroit Water Project, which is helping pay people's water bills. She also worked at IDEO. She worked at Puma and Reebok. She's just a really cool person, and we feel lucky that we got to talk to her about some things that are important to us, but we're not remotely qualified to talk about on our own.
So this whole last week, we were hanging out in the top 10 charts of the iTunes store for tech podcasts. Thanks so much if you've left us a review, a rating on iTunes. Seriously, every single one of those helps. Anytime we end up on the charts, it gets the show in front of new people who get to hear the show and then they share it. So if you're enjoying the show so far, if you've listened to past episodes, or even if this is your first one, a review on iTunes, even just a star rating, helps so, so much. So thank you. For everyone who's leaving us thoughts and reviews, we really appreciate that. Of course, if you have any ideas, suggestions, or feedback for Bryn or myself, you can hit us up on Twitter. We're at DesignDetailsFM. We're reading and responding to all of your tweets. It's been amazing to see them just sort of flow in throughout the week. Different ideas, suggestions. People are giving us some thoughts on how we can improve the show. So definitely don't hesitate to hit us up on Twitter. If you have anything like that, we're at DesignDetailsFM. And before we get into the show, we have two sponsors we want to thank. Our first sponsor is Weebly. They're the easiest way for designers to build beautiful websites. They have really powerful drag and drop tools that let you focus on the design while Weebly takes care of everything else. Best of all, editing sites with Weebly is so simple. You can let your clients make their own updates once you've designed it. It takes up a lot less of your time. You can try Weebly for free today at Weebly.com. Thanks, Weebly.
Once again, our second sponsor is Hover. You all know Hover. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domains. They make the whole domain management process just so simple, and their customer support is just the best. If you haven't bought a domain on Hover yet, you just got to try it. Thanks once again to Hover. And now, let's get down to episode 4 with Christy Tillman. What are you working on lately? What are you excited about?
So I'm working at Society of the Grownups right now, and so we're a startup that is focusing on changing financial literacy for like 22 to 40 year olds. And so we have classes in our space. We have a really beautiful space in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. And we have events, chats, guest speakers. People come into our space basically for either classes on finances or to get one-on-one advice. And so one of our value props is making this kind of information democratized and accessible to people. So, you know, usually it's like you have to have a lot of money to talk to a financial planner. You don't know where to start, but we have this space where people can come in and learn about student loans, learn about saving for retirement, learn about buying their first house. So all this kind of financial information, we're making it available to people like our age. And right now we're in Brookline. Yeah. So we're definitely thinking about how to get it to everyone. So.
And you started there in June?
Yeah, I started the first week in July. And before that, I was at IDEO for almost 4 years. Actually worked on it at IDEO.
So were you working remotely for IDEO before then? Because they're in the UK, right?
Oh, no. So IDEO has offices globally, like I want to say 12, 13, 14. So they have New York, Boston, Palo Alto, San Francisco, Chicago, and just in the United States, but Asia, Europe.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I didn't realize that. I'd only seen a few things from IDEO previously. You also are working on some side projects that are fairly exciting.
Yeah, I'm working on with Tiffany. We started the Detroit Water Project around June. We were looking to kind of help people in Detroit because they have a water crisis going on with the Detroit Water and Sewage Department cutting off water. And we just got on Twitter and we're like, if we could just pay one person's bill, like, how could we go about doing that? And it was literally just a Twitter convo between her and I. And we found a list of where the water department posts delinquent accounts. And we just put in one of the account numbers in the website. And we realized we could get in without a password. And we're like, eureka. So if we just had a list of people who we could pay their bills, then how big could we get? So we just put together literally Google spreadsheets and put them on Twitter. And it blew up, and we've gotten almost $200,000 in contributions. So people directly pay water bills. We match them, so no money goes to us.
Wow. So that's awesome.
Right. We matched them with people in need in Detroit, and you can pay someone to build directly. And we just got into Y Combinator for winter 2015. So I
assume you're one of the nonprofits in winter 15.
Yes.
How does being a nonprofit work with Y Combinator?
You apply like everyone else. They don't take equity for nonprofits, but you get the same amount of money. You get all the same resources. So it's pretty much the same as a for-profit company.
Why does Y Combinator do that? Like, I get they want to help nonprofits. What's in it for them?
Nonprofits, the word nonprofit, I think, is a little bit of a misnomer. It doesn't mean you don't make any money. It just means you don't have like a board or shareholders and stuff. So, I mean, right. It still functions as a regular company. And one of the interesting things, and as you guys probably know, like about startups, is they start off as one thing and go to another. So it's like we started off as a nonprofit, but there's ways to monetize what we've made, and it could be not a nonprofit, as we kind of develop what it's gonna be. But there's a multitude of reasons, and you can grow nonprofits to be really big companies too.
Right. Okay. Cool. That's exciting. So what are the future plans? How's that gonna scale out, I guess, to other cities or around the world?
Yeah, Tiff and I have been thinking about that. And there's like a multitude of directions. It could be other cities. It could be that we look at different types of crisis. Like, how do we identify crisis? It could be that we look at other utility services or other services that are typically publicly funded. It could be that we kind of think about how you fund social services in general through community versus through the government. So there's just a lot of ways to go about it.
So as a designer, are you looking into like creating a way for people to interface with this better? Or is it more of a focus on the social aspect of it rather than the design side?
Yeah, it definitely needs a lot of design work. The interesting thing is Tiffany and I aren't in the same city when we started this. So I'm in Boston and she's in Oakland. And so that's made it a little difficult for certain things to happen that would happen better, you know, if you were like in the same space. But yeah, we're definitely working on getting the user experience a lot better. I mean, it's basically just a prototype, you know, right now.
Yeah, that's super cool that you guys are going after it when it's so far away from both of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of insane that, like, there was a news story that came out that prompted our conversation that they were thinking about calling the United Nations in to help with the water crisis. I'm just like, we're the United States, right? We don't need the United Nations to help people with basic utilities. Like, I think we're better than that as a community, you know, as global citizens. And we have people all over the world sending money. Like, we've had people from Ireland, from Australia, from Dubai, I've spoken to. So it kind of caught a lot of international attention, too.
That's super cool. That's such an amazing project. What kind of got your attention with that? Was it just, like, the fact that it was getting a lot of visibility, or... do you know anyone there?
Yeah, so we don't really know anyone in Detroit. I've been there a couple of times for work purposes, but like I said, we just latched on to the fact that this crisis was going on, and I don't even really think that has gotten a ton of attention. I mean, Detroit had a bankruptcy. They've been going through a bankruptcy proceeding, but I don't really think, I mean, in general, people have been paying attention to the decline of the city, but I don't think really anybody nationally has a great grip on like all the different issues that are hitting the city, because there's a lot of different things. Like, there's issues with property taxes. There's issues with pensions. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And we've learned a lot more about the city as we've done this project. I don't really think it's gotten a ton of attention like that specific problem. So that's one of the reasons we really wanted to help to sort of bring light to the issue.
That seems to be kind of a focus for you on like the kind of marginalized communities. Like, I saw your piece on the New York Times, which is incredible, about women and minorities being targeted online. Has that been a long-term mission of yours to help improve that? Or is that kind of been a focus like locally or recently? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, I think so. There's not like a lot of Black designers in general working on huge, big problems. And I think it's, you know, there's been a lot of talk about like diversity in tech, and there hasn't been as much, I think, talk about diversity in design. But the two issues run parallel, and they both have similar, you know, common problems, right? Pipeline problems and that kind of thing. So it's just been my background. You know, I come from a kind of working class background. I'm with neither one of my parents were college educated. I have 3 college degrees. And so it's just a part of me to help give back and use my talents for, you know, other things other than corporate exploits all the time. So it's just like, how can I give back? How can I help solve these problems that I see? Because, you know, as designers, we each have a lens that you just can't get rid of, right? And that's my lens. I see a lot of issues. I see a lot of social problems. So it's like, how can I use my talents for that? Even when I had the IDEO, I tried to get myself on a lot of social projects. Like, I did a lot of work on type 2 diabetes. I did some educational projects. So I've always been trying to kind of get on projects, you know, that had like a little element of good in them, because that's what motivates me. So even with Society of Grown Ups, right, it's amazing that we can offer these financial services to people who don't have a ton of money and make a difference in people's lives and help them learn how to manage their money. So I'm always looking for that element. I just can't work on for example, I've been offered positions at social media companies, right? Like, that just doesn't feel right to me, like the type of work I want to be doing. So
it's interesting you mentioned that, because this last year was kind of the big breakout of the diversity reports, right? We had a diversity report from Facebook, Twitter, Apple, Google, like all the big ones. I'm curious how you reacted to those. And then I wanted to dig in a little bit deeper to those diversity reports.
I wasn't really shocked. I mean, when people will come to me and ask me, well, do you know so-and-so, or can you help me find a resource? And I can really only think of a handful. For example, someone asked me, well, do you know any other Black designers? We're trying to do a program about it. And I can really only name a couple of my friends, right? So I'm not shocked that those kind of numbers came out. I actually volunteer for this organization called Boston Youth Design, and they place high school kids, mostly Black, Latino, and Asian kids, in design internships in the summer in Boston. So I'm really involved in that. And so I kind of really can see how the dearth of talent and the dearth of people coming. Even when I was in my design program, I was like one of 2 African-American designers. So those numbers didn't shock me. I mean, I think it's kind of plain to see, so I wasn't really surprised.
Can you just talk a little bit more about why that is? Like, why are there so few Black or even just minority designers in general across the industry?
I think it's a complex problem. I think I think it probably all goes back to money and as a broader umbrella. But for example, I was the first, neither of my parents are college educated, right? I went to business school first because my parents thought that that's what would give me a great career. I actually did internships with very high profile companies. I was in a 5-year MBA program and I decided I hated business. And then I went to grad school to buy some time. I actually applied to a PhD program and 3 design schools. And I was like, okay, I'll just take a gamble. And I actually was like, okay, I'm just going to go to the design program. I got accepted into a design school and I got accepted into PhD. And I was like, never mind. So it's like, people, when you're like, come from an economically disadvantaged background, you make decisions that are proven, right? So my parents were like, okay, go get an MBA, right? No one thinks to go to art school. That doesn't make any money. And that's kind of, you know, the stereotype about art school. So it's like a lack of exposure. That's one of the big ones. When I work with different kids at Youth Design, their parents are like, okay, cool, my kids are in the summer program. But it doesn't really translate right into actual, I guess, designers, because people want their kids to do things that they're sure that can give them a good lifestyle. So I think a huge part of that is generally just lack of exposure to the career field. Like, even my parents now, they don't like know what I do, right? They know that I do something cool. They know that I don't have to ever call them for money. So they know that I can take care of myself and be self-sufficient.
That's a good thing.
And so that's good enough for them, right? And so it's like, okay, so people don't really send their kids, you know, it's seen as a luxury to send your child to art school. So I think that's one of the biggest reasons. I think there's also hiring reasons. Like, I think that I'm a pretty good designer and I know I've applied to certain places and I've not even gotten a call back. And I'm not to say that they owe me anything, but I definitely think there's problems in the hiring process that keeps people out. So that's another big one. I think all the problems that we talk about in terms of technology, it applies to design as well. There's not a lot of even And this is sort of a circular problem, right? There's not a lot of like big name black designers. Like there's Eddie Opara.
Jared Arandu.
Right. But I mean, I know Jared on Twitter, but I don't think like people, I don't think like some 15-year-old kid, right, who's looking at design publications, you know, they might not see Jared. They might see Eddie Opara at Pentagram. They might see, and you know, that's about all I can name. There's another lady, I can't think of her name right now, in New York. Yeah. She was a teacher. She worked at Rolling Stone. I can't recall her name right now. But I mean, that's it, right? So it's like a cyclical thing. If you don't see people that look like you in a profession, it probably also doesn't interest you.
If you would have asked me like a few days ago, I would have thought I could name a lot more than that. And now I just can't. That's, wow.
Right. Yeah, I'm almost always the only one at every place I've ever worked. So before I worked at Puma, I was at Puma, and before I was at Puma, I was at Reebok. Reebok actually had a good handful of black designers, but most of them were fashion apparel designers. They weren't really graphic design. So yeah, it's tough. So, and it's a complicated issue too. I mean, there's, in terms of tech, there's like Kimberly Bryant. She's doing Black Girls Code. There's not really an equivalent for that, for design.
Yeah.
Is that a project you'd be interested in working on, or are you a little bit tied up right now?
I'd love to work on that. Like, I would love to work on that.
I'm sure that takes quite a few resources.
Exactly. I mean, that's a tricky problem. I was just about to say, I was like, I'd love to work on that, but I have to, you know, pay my rent and my car note and my insurance. And, you know, so it's like, maybe one day when I get more comfortable, I'll take a, you know, jump off a cliff and take a leap into that. But yeah, that kind of work, that kind of mission work that Kimberly Bryant is doing, it takes an incredible amount of guts and resources. And it was rough for her at the beginning, and she's just now, you know, seeing like lots of success. But
I'm really excited to see cool stuff come out of that. Women in general are underrepresented in the tech field, like not just in design, but we see a significant lack of women in design. Like, we had a hard time finding like a significant amount to interview on Dribbble. Like, that's kind of where we started with a lot of people, and we went to Twitter and we still didn't find a ton right away. Like, it was kind of tough, and Jared hooked us up. He gave us a list of like 50 women that are just incredible designers that we just didn't really realize that they considered themselves designers.
You know what? Also, too, Bryn, has to do with, and I've recently learned this in my job, because my boss is such a fierce woman, is that we women sometimes completely downplay ourselves. And one thing my boss said to me, because we're getting ready to do like our reviews, and we had to write like, what are you good at? What are you great at? And what do you need to work on? And she said, and I had a really hard time with this. I could not write a lot about what I was great at. And she was like, you're so great. She was like, if you were a guy, you would have been good at one thing and you would have written 10 things. But she's like, you're good at 10 things and you only wrote one thing. And, you know, but that's true, right? So, like, I've been reading this book, like, Lean In and Confidence Code. Yep. Like, there's a huge chasm there for women, like, really making the case for ourselves, really speaking up, having the confidence to be like real standout leaders, right? So girls, like, we learn to downplay ourselves super early, and you know, that is a part of the problem.
Yeah, we hear that so often. Like, Satya Nadella did that talk about how women, they don't need to like work to make that pay gap go away, because it'll just happen. That's such a weird concept to me, because there's so many women I know that are very vocal and thoughtful, and I mean, they make themselves known, right? Like, they work hard for it and they're not afraid to tell people. But then, like, that doesn't necessarily, that's not necessarily representative of the entire female population, right? So I
totally agree.
It's such an interesting problem, and it doesn't have an easy solution either.
And it's also really hard too sometimes when you're in an all male environment. Like, I've worked in places where I was like one of maybe two or three women out of like 20 total people, and it's just, there's just a lot of self-doubt that goes on in your head. And, you know, you're like just as talented as everyone else in the room. And you're just like, man, I can't believe I'm in this room with these other talented designers. I think it's called imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome, yes.
Yeah.
If you have that, it means you're a designer. Yeah, totally.
So, there you go.
Well, that was your reaction when I first sent you the guest list that we were working on when I asked you to join us. And you're like, why am I on this list? I'm like, because you're awesome. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I was like, wow. Yeah, totally. So that's probably something that I'm actively working on. I'm actually speaking at the product design conference at the end of January in New York City. And I've been asked to speak at conferences before, and I've always turned them down. Like, why would anyone want to hear what I have to say? And so I'm purposefully putting myself out there and like pushing myself to do this conference so that maybe I can break the ice on this kind of like promoting yourself, or, you know, just having confidence to just speak with authority about whatever you're working on. So I'm going to be doing
super
that
awesome.
In January.
Hey, just want to take a quick break to thank our sponsor of this episode, Weebly. Weebly lets you say goodbye to those pesky updates and maintenance work that comes with managing a website for a client. Things like changing a paragraph of text or updating a photo, stuff that would normally take all this back and forth, emails and video calls just to update one small thing. No more. Weebly lets you just hand the website off to your client. The tool has really, really simple features, drag and drop interface. Seriously, anyone can pick it up. Anyone can use it. The bottom line is that Weebly lets you spend more time doing the things you love, like designing cool websites, and gives you happy clients that feel enabled to update their own website. They have the flexibility to keep the site up to date and get the most out of the beautiful site you've created for them. You can take Weebly for a test drive for free at Weebly.com, or they're at Dribbble.com/Weebly. Weebly lets you do more design and less maintenance. Thanks, Weebly. I'm curious to hear how things are going at Society of Grownups on the design side. It's like such a interesting concept, like you're trying to democratize financial advice. And I've, you know, checked out the website and the videos, and talk to me a little bit about how designs played a part in the company coming up and how you think about design at the company.
Right. So like, so Society of Grownups is born out of collaboration between IDEO and MassMutual, almost 2 years in the making. And in its very DNA, at the very core of its DNA is design research. And, that's something we're carrying over into, the start of the company. So we've launched in October. We opened our doors in October, and so far I was the only designer. We're bringing on a new designer in January, two new designers in January, I'm sorry. And we're looking for two more. So we're quickly growing our design team. We have a full-time researcher on staff, and so we consider ourselves an MVE. So pretty much everything is up for grabs. The name of my talk at the product design conference is Designing Out in the Open, because that's basically what we're going to be doing. Well, what we are doing, we're running lots of experiments on the service model, on the curriculum, on how to give advice, on the food that we have in the cafe, on the website. And so it's just a bunch of moving parts. And like I said, I'm leading the effort, and this is my first time as a design leader. So I'm learning a ton about myself and making a ton of mistakes, and I'm learning to live with them, and that's totally fine. And so what we're doing is a lot of testing, very rapid iteration on things, and we're beefing up our design team to kind of support that and our research team. So this came out of IDEO. You know, IDEO is known for its design thinking, and I came from IDEO. I feel like I cut my teeth, even though I've worked at other design places. I feel like I cut my teeth at IDEO. And so at the heart of our project or our company is definitely design research. So everything's open. Everything's up for change. And teaching, I think one of the biggest challenges has been teaching people who aren't designers how to think like a designer. I'm used to working with a team of designers, and we kind of just, you know, siege on a project and we do our thing and we come up. But working with people who aren't designers has been like a whole new world for me, and really trying to figure out how to get them to think intentionally about things, how to get them to not make assumptions. How do we ask the right questions? Are we designing for the right question? So it's been a lot of teaching, and the more you teach, the more you learn. So it's just basically reinforcing a lot of stuff that I already knew.
Could you tell me more about that? Like, what are some lessons that you've ended up teaching, or maybe mistakes you've learned along the way specifically?
one of the biggest mistakes I've made is, I guess, not being directional enough. So really having to take time to help people kind of set themselves up for success. That's one of the things I really having to do, is because I'm one person, right? I can't control all of it. So having trust in teammates, specifically ones who aren't designers, is one of the biggest things that I'm learning right now. And also giving them the tools and setting them free and hoping and, you know, wishing and praying and trusting that they come back with the right results. So that's been a huge thing, and it's ongoing. And I can say that I'm proud of my team, because they are really like taking on to it and running their own experiments and recording things. And, you know, it's been really great to watch that kind of happen. So that's kind of one of the biggest mistakes I've made. It's like, I guess, not giving people enough credit for being able to do the same work that I do.
Have you experimented with ways to kind of let them show off their work internally or externally to kind of promote that?
What do you mean by show off? So I know, like, one thing we do have is we have a big whiteboard downstairs where we're going to be recording all of our experiments now, and so that we can actually keep track of them all and hold each other accountable for the results. That's been interesting, because I'm used to having everything on the board, and we've been like between offices. So, I mean, it's really a scrappy thing. So,
yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about. Like, sometimes, like, when you're just sharing a spreadsheet or something that has the results, it's kind of tough. But when you give someone the opportunity to present the results they found, it really creates an interesting environment that kind of like pushes up that personal confidence in what they're doing.
I totally agree. It's funny that you asked that, because I just sent an email, because today was my last day in the office. So I just sent an email today rounding up the different work streams and telling them about our new meeting structure for 2015 that we're going to try in terms of presenting research and everyone being responsible for their own stream of research. And then myself and our researcher helping guide them with experiments and helping them just, you know, kind of hone what they're doing and letting them go off and do those things. So yes, we were looking at spreadsheets. That didn't work. And so now we're going to start putting stuff up on the walls everywhere. We're really structuring our research really tightly. It's just been an effort. We've been between two offices, which has been interesting. So learning the importance of space, which is something I already knew. But other people haven't really understood that. And that's one of the things that have had to kind of bring home. It's like, look, we have to have our space, because we have to have somewhere to design. So I think one of the interesting things is I'm coming from a consultancy where we had, like, I won't say endless resources, but we had a lot of resources that I took for granted. And kind of really adapting to a more scrappy environment has been interesting.
How many people are on the Society of Grownups team?
I want to say we're at 14 now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we have financial planners on our team. We have community managers. I have a researcher. We have a content management strategist, designers, and we are building up our tech team. We actually just posted 8 job postings for our development team today. So we're growing very fast. We've had a lot of engagement. People really love the classes. We have people, we've been selling out classes left and right. People are really hungry for this type of information. So those numbers have, you know, justified us being able to grow kind of fast.
That's awesome. How are you in the trenches of design every day? Are you like totally in a leadership role at this point?
I am totally in the trenches. I've
been
in the trenches.
How's that?
It is grueling. I've been executing like nobody's business. I have not executed like this rapidly in a long time, but I was hired for a leadership position, and it's just really just a function of, you know, us getting done what we need to get done. We're beefing up. We've justified our engagement strategy to the point where we can bring more people on. So I'll actually be going up to leadership mostly, because we're hiring a bunch of designers to actually, you know, do more of the execution part. But I've been like in the trenches, like making stuff, posters, gift cards, bags,
nice,
merchandise,
nice.
Curriculum.
Filling
slide
in all the
decks,
gaps.
You name it, I've made it.
You got one of my favorite designers involved, at least for, I think, one mural, Dan Casaro.
Yeah, so Dan did our outside mural, and then Eric,
God,
and I don't want to mispronounce his last name, but he works with Jessica Hish.
Eric Marinovich.
Yes, he did our mural in the actual space. And it is beautiful and people love it.
There's a sushi restaurant right by my house that he did the wall for, and it is just incredible.
Yeah, so that's another thing we do. Like, we're like, you know, we want to host, like, we're really community-based, so we've been hosting events in our space. I want to do a Creative Mornings eventually. You know, and surfacing design talent is another thing that I'm really interested in. So I think it's so cool that I'm actually allowed to do those things, and I don't really have to ask for permission very much to do
what I
want.
That's amazing. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So how does that community element scale to a larger market? Do you have an idea for that yet, or
I do, but I don't think I can talk about it.
That's fair. That's fair.
No. Spill the secrets. Spill them.
So you said you've been cranking a lot. Do you show off your work anywhere, or is that pretty tightly held as well?
So when I was at IDEO, I really had nothing I could really show because everything is NDA down. And now that I have a ton of work from Society of Grownups that I can show, I just have not had time to put it up on the site. So once we get
once we
bring some of our designers on, like I have one designer who's really cool who's starting on the 5th, and then I'm bringing another one on at the end of the month. I think we want to create a team Dribbble and a team Behance account where we can show off all of the collateral that we're making.
That's awesome! I'm so excited to see that. I was just going to ask how you're going to do it.
Yeah, so I want to do that. I think we're going to start blogging to the design team because we have a blog on our site. I think we're probably going to start doing more of that now that we, you know, have more headcount. Because design is just so crucial to Society of Grownups, you know, from the way it works to the way it looks. So,
yeah, you're working on such unique problems too. Like, they're not easy. Like, people aren't necessarily comfortable talking about their finances with other people.
That's so true. People will talk about sex before they talk about, like, their finances. It's the craziest thing. Like, people will tell you everything they did last night, but they will not tell you how much money they made. But our financial planners are actually pretty amazing, and it's interesting because, like, we actually rotate one of our research strategies is having different grown-ups, our team, sit in the classes and observe them and then kind of report after what they found about engagement, how people use the materials, all types of things that we're looking at. And so it's really been interesting to see, like, when people are in the room with where everyone's, like, congregated and saying that, hey, I have the same problem. Like, I'm behind on my student loans, or I have a lot of student loans. People open up and they talk. Or if there's, like, one person who starts off, other people will say, okay, it's okay for me to kind of talk about my credit or my student loans. We're also working on technology tools, too, to help some of those more private conversations. So, like, polling from iPhones and iPods in the classes is something we're working on. So the instructor can ask a question and people can anonymously answer it, and we can see the results in the class so that the instructor can kind of know, like, who's in the room in terms of how to tailor their presentation. So that's another big thing that we're working on in terms of technology.
What's the hardest design challenge that you're working on at this moment in time?
It's probably the curriculum. So getting the curriculum just right, it's like...
The curriculum, could you just explain
classes. For example, like, understanding who's in the class. So if we're running credit and debt, people will come in who have a ton of debt, and then people may come in who are really good at managing their debt or they don't have any debt. And so tailoring the classes for the right audience has been really hard. Writing the class descriptions and getting them right, having the classes at the right level, it's been very difficult. And, you know, how do you message that to people? Because these topics are just so big. So basically setting expectations for people when they register for a class has been something that we've been really kind of working on. Like, we've added more content, we've taken content down. We're working on bundling classes. So what happens if a spending class and credit to debt runs together for a longer period of time? Should it be a workshop? Should it be a chat? So we have a couple of different formats. Like, we have chats, which are shorter, and then we have classes, which are longer. So that's been, we've been tinkering with that for a while. And that's one of the reasons we kind of sit in the classes too. Like, each one of us is responsible for sitting in a class and taking those kind of, getting that feedback And we also ask the people who sit in the class for feedback as well. So we get a lot of feedback in terms of our instructors and setting expectations for like what is the content of the class.
There's been a huge wave of budgeting apps that I've seen come out where it's like really, really simple one screen apps where you plug in your bank account information and they try and do these interesting things with design, showing you like a progress meter or some sort of visual representation of your budget. They seem to maybe take some of the human element out of like financial planning or having a in-person class. Can apps like that be effective, or do you feel like there's a human element needed to be successful when it comes to managing money?
Well, that's the question. And I think the answer to that would be a huge assumption. And when we go to kind of get to that point, we're definitely going to be looking at both options and trying to figure out which one of those. I think the question is completely open. It could be that, you know, there are a ton of budget apps or a ton of financial apps. It could be like, you know, that's just one of those nuts that you just can't crack. Or it could be that, you know, someone's just haven't done it the right way. Or it could be that you just really have to have a human. And we're prepared. We've already thought about this a lot. So we're prepared to kind of go down both roads in terms of like testing when we do research. That's like the one, that's actually like the one of the biggest questions we have in terms of digital conversion and bringing our classroom and one-on-one advice to people. Totally.
What's the measures of success there? Like, is it number of people that manage their money well by some level, or is there an objective way to measure the success of apps that help you with budgeting?
So right now, we like in our physical space, we're looking at engagement in terms of people who take classes and people who repeat. In terms of digital stuff, and even in our classes, we've been thinking a lot about actionability. So is it enough just for people to come in the class and give information? Or do we want to, or is the goal to have them take action? And that's actually one of the things we're testing, like in some of the content, in terms of like the workshops. For example, the student loan workshop, it went from a class and now it's actually a workshop where people actually, the instructor shows you how to go to the National Federal Loan Database and pull all your loans, right? Or the credit and debt workshop where you kind of, you get to Credit Karma and you pull your credit report and you can get like more one-on-one instruction. So the idea of taking action, I think, is huge. I think that's kind of the proof is in the pudding, right? And how you measure that, it's, I don't know yet. That's like one of the things we're going to have to figure out. And we've asked that question too. Like taking action is huge for us because that's how we know like some of the curriculum is a success. We don't, you know, it's just not enough for people to sit in the class and just absorb it. So we're trying to design for that. We're trying to like think about how do we bridge our one-on-one sessions in our classes. So, you know, after you take a class, you get a one-on-one session with a planner to help you come up with a plan. How do we get people to come back after they've spent some time and let their plan kind of sit with them? What have they done afterwards? So all of those are questions that we're asking and trying to design for.
Do you find that the people who come to the class are a pretty diverse audience? I would imagine that that's a pretty broad problem.
Yeah, it's diverse. It's super diverse. And that's actually one of our kind of like values as well, is reaching diversity. I don't know if you've seen our Don't Panic stuff on our Twitter account and on our website. But
no, I had not currently.
Our grownups are diverse. We have people, we have college kids. We have 30 and 40, 50, 60-year-olds come in our space. We have people who have zero savings. We have people who have some savings. It's very diverse. And even when people, you know, don't have a particular need, they know someone that does. So it's like parents will come in and say, hey, I want to get a gift card for my son for the student loan class. Or, you know, so it's a huge problem and everyone has it. So, yeah, we see a lot of different people. And we also kind of incorporate that in our materials as well in terms of design. Like the people that you see reflected in our materials are a diverse range of people. And not just ethnicity, but like types of families and that kind of thing too. So we want those people to feel reflected in our space.
Just want to jump in once again for a quick second to thank Hover. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. They remove all the hassle and just give you what you need instead of trying to nag and upsell you on add-ons and extras. Their site is clean, simple, beautiful, and really just makes managing your domains a breeze. If you ever run into trouble, They've got an amazing customer service team to help you out. I use them for all my domains, and they're the only registrar I've really enjoyed using. If you've never used Hover, go to their site, search a few keywords, see if you find something you like. If you already have some domains, you should really try out their valet transfer service. I used it to transfer over some of my domains, and it still blows my mind that that exists. Either way, use promo code That Should Be a Plugin at checkout, all one word, and you'll save 10% on your first purchase. The only link came from the show, which really helps us out, and you'll get a great domain on a great service. Thanks once again to Hover.
I don't want to change topics too fast. I was just in the back of my mind, you guys are like hiring so much tech talent. Have you noticed an issue with that or trouble finding design talent on the East Coast? I know it's continues to be a problem over here.
Yes. Yes.
So what are you guys doing about that?
One of our, I know one of our tech positions has been on the website since like the beginning. We've had
a design position.
No, one of our developer
oh,
positions.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh man.
We're having to go after people. I actually told Bryn this, but I spent time going on Dribbble and looking at talented people's portfolios and actually emailing them. And I'm going to do that again over the holidays. It is tough. Everyone's competing for the same people. And one thing I've learned, because I've looked at, I want to say I've looked at least 200 design portfolios within the last 3 weeks. And I can say with my hand on the Bible that all the talented designers are already employed. They are not applying for jobs. Let me tell you, the ratio of okay to oh my God portfolios is pretty high. So I'm actually going to start getting a lot more strategic and going after talented people and giving them something and a reason to come over to talk to us. Because yeah. All those people are employed.
Yeah. What are some of the common mistakes you see?
That's a good thing. So here's the thing with designers, like young designers don't know good work from bad work. They go for quantity and not quality. I mean, every designer has some work that we're not proud of, right? And that's always going to be
sure.
The case.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But it's like young designers will pack their portfolios with everything, or they think just because it has a national brand or something on it that they should always include it. And they don't know how to curate their portfolios well, and they don't know what their good work is and their bad work. So I see a lot of inconsistencies. Like I'll see something that says, maybe I want to email this person back. And then I scroll a little bit more. I go, so that's one of the big things. Two, a lot of the good work looks alike. People are really like stuck in trends. They don't want to try anything new.
Definitely.
It just all looks like it came off of Dribbble University. So those are the two biggest things I've seen. Then there's just plain bad work. And here's a tip too that I've noticed, that people don't understand that design positions are written with a specific job in mind. So if you're applying for a print position, don't apply for the print position, the digital position, the UX position. You can't
do them all.
Exactly. So it makes me think that you don't really know what you're good at or what you want to do if you apply for all of the open design positions with the same portfolio. Like, don't do that. Pick a job and apply for it. Don't apply for all the jobs. It tells me you don't really know what you're doing.
How much does culture fit weigh into your decision when looking at designers? Is that a factor?
Yeah, it definitely. So what I do is I really quickly scan, and I can really tell within about 45 seconds if I want to talk to someone.
45 seconds based on 45. Just looking at their portfolio?
Mm-hmm. I'll look
Holy
at their portfolio.
Crap.
Well, that's an elimination. Let me take that back. That's elimination. If it's something interesting, then I'll poke. Like, I'll go to the website that they say they designed, or I'll go to their Behance and look at other work or whatever.
You can't afford to spend 45 right. minutes on each person. Like,
right.
That's,
I can't. And the volume of portfolio that I get is a lot. So 45 seconds, I can decide I don't want to talk to someone. And then if I do, I'll poke around and see. And then I'll send them an email and say, hey, you want to talk on the phone? You know, I thought your work was pretty interesting. And yes, culture fit is huge. people have to really be able to live with uncertainty and a lot of ambiguity when they work in startups, because everything is just always moving and you have to be comfortable with it and you have to be able to take ownership of your work stream. And that's super, super important. No one has time to hold your hand. And you just have to really be able to just jump in and be able to contribute on day one. So that's really, you know, what I'm really looking for. And so I talked to them. If they sound great, we'll bring them in. So we have a new person starting on the 5th. He's super awesome and super talented. And I cannot wait to work with him.
Can you share his name? We can definitely link to him on the show notes.
Christopher Minkin. He works, I think his Twitter is @CMICHON. I think that's his Twitter. Yeah, he's awesome. And so he'll be coming to work with us and really taking ownership of the curriculum design, which is a huge undertaking. We have a lot of work streams, so I probably should say that. Like,
I've actually never heard the term work stream before.
Really?
No. What do you mean by that?
So a work stream is just basically a path, right? So our service model, like how do you come in the door? What happens when you come in the door? What happens when you go to the cafe? What happens when you go to the library? What happens when you go to the classroom? How do you interact with the instructor? What do the materials look like? So that's like the service, right? How do you go to a checkup or a financial therapy? So that's kind of like the service model. And then we have all of the content for the classes, which are building the curriculum. That's a whole work stream in itself. How do you design the actual output of the materials and actual the content? So that's the curriculum work stream. And then we have the community managers who go out and do partnerships, who run the cafe, who run the library. That's a whole work stream. And then our technology. And so all these things collide and people have ownership of all of them. And that's kind of how we kind of organize it.
Do you think that's like a physical space product kind of terminology? Like we're always got our heads buried in apps. So like we think about user flows and stuff. And
yeah, that's the closest comparison I can make is like a UX
sprints?
Flow. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I've never heard of
it. Yeah, totally.
It
probably would be the same thing. Yeah, I think it definitely manifests that we're a physical space, but we also have a digital space and we have a product. Yeah, so maybe that's why. We've been just... I don't even know where that word came from. It just kind of popped up and we've just been using it. But
it's
it
a
makes
good word.
Sense to us.
Yeah, it's very obvious about what it is.
Designing a physical work stream like that sounds... I can't even wrap my mind around that. Like, if someone walks in the door, how do you design that first experience? Can you share some stuff you've learned about this stuff?
Meet like, space user onboarding?
Yeah, yeah. Like, actually designing the room or, I mean, do you think about like...
Yeah, so
smells and temperature
in,
and all this kind of stuff.
Exactly. When people walk in, like, okay, do we want them to go to the, we have a community manager, we have community managers in the cafe, in the classroom, in the library. So wherever you go in the space, there's someone that can actually talk to you about what we're doing. Then we have a computer there that helps you, that you can register. And so how do you get people to register for classes is one thing we've been trying to really, in the space, really help them with. How do you get people, one of the big things too is how do you get people to leave after a class? So our class
how do you do it? I'm so serious.
You really have to design for this too, because people will literally stay in the space like an hour and a half after class, after a class gets out at 8, and you know people are ready to go home, you know, it's time to shut down the space and people just want to stay. And that's actually one of the problems we're working on, like how do you design to get people out of the door. Also, too, how do you design to make community? So we have these interesting tables that we got from Fort Standard in our classroom. And we've actually been changing the table configuration every other class and recording what happens and how do people engage with each other based on the configuration. One of our types of formats is a supper club where people actually have a very nice dinner over one of the classes, during one of the classes. And so we've been experimenting whether that should be a buffet, should it be family style. I sat in on one that was family style. It was super awkward because I wanted chicken, but chicken was at the other end of the table and I didn't want to...
Ah, those monsters.
I didn't want to interrupt the class asking for chicken, right? So I just stuck with a short rib because it was by me, right? So it's like,
That's a really interesting problem to have to solve for users. I mean, that's...
Exactly. So it's like all these interactions in this space really require intentionality. Like, I was talking to one of the community managers, and she was saying that when she puts out snacks for the classes, because the snacks are packaged, people feel like they can't take them because they think they have to pay for them first. So, so it's literally like, and so we were like, well, why aren't people eating snacks in the class? We provided snacks, right? And people weren't taking them. And now we put a sign in. Now people take them, right? So it's like every little interaction in the service model requires thought. And, you know, you don't ever really think, you know, that you're designing for taking chips. But it's super important that people, like, have nourishment during the classes because they're coming after work. You know, we want to make sure that they feel good and they have something to eat and snack on while they're there. So, like, we even, like, have been rotating different types of snacks. And, like, how do people react to those different types of snacks? So, like, the service experience is super, super important. And I've, like, you know, when I was at IDO, I worked on tons of service experience. Like, you know, like, how do you get people through a line? I worked on the Converse project where we kind of experimented with, will people pay for shoes if they had to leave the store without the shoe, then we shipped them because they had an inventory problem, right? So always thinking about these interactions in space is something I've done before. So it's, you know, it's super natural to me to kind of think about it in the grown-up space in the same way. And, you know, helping my coworkers think about that, you know, because they don't really think about that as a design problem. And I see it as definitely a design problem.
Definitely. I was curious if you discovered any maybe like generalities or like quirks of human behavior and human psychology.
Are there patterns you can predict?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's speak in broad stroke stereotypes here.
Let me see.
That always goes well.
Oh, yeah. So this is a funny one. The locks on the bathroom. So we had, our space is brand new, and we had these pin locks. They're really thin buttons that actually locked the bathroom. And people like that came back were not like using them, and employees too. Like there was this issue about the bathroom and people didn't really want to use them. They wanted to go downstairs. So we changed the locks. Now we have deadbolt locks in the bathroom and people feel more secure to use the bathrooms now.
How did you figure that out? How did you know it's just the lock?
Talking to people. So I pretty much live in the space and you go out and you just talk to people. And just sit at, sometimes I'll leave my computer and I'll go sit in the library and talk to people. And they'll talk to me. They don't know who I am and they just tell me everything. So I do that a lot. Like, I really like, it's easy to be a designer and like go in the corner, but we're such a new thing that no one's really ever done before. So it requires talking to people a lot.
That's so cool. Going from these like insane levels of detail in the physical like space, how does that translate to working on a digital product then?
That's a great question.
I guess we're kind of running up against your time limit. You said you were pretty low, but I know that's kind of a deep question.
So I guess I'm going to say that I don't know yet. I mean, the overarching umbrella is really intentionality. And because we haven't done it yet, I can't really say.
Okay.
But I mean, it's the same team of people working on it that is working on the physical space. Mostly we have more digital people on it, of course. But that same level of intentionality that it's kind of like the hallmark of our brand will be brought over into the digital space. I don't know how that's going to play out yet. We just haven't done it yet.
I can't wait to see how that's going to turn out, because any web developer or app designer, like, especially onboarding, like that just comes to mind. Like, we think about that for hours and hours and hours. How do you make that first experience warm?
Analogous,
right?
Experience, you're definitely correct, is onboarding.
Well, yeah. So, like, how do you make that first experience warm? What were you going to say?
Another problem is that, like, a bunch of 25-year-old overpaid white kids in a city, we're not good at managing our finances, right? Like, I'm super excited. Do you know when that product's coming, like, going to be available out here?
I can't really talk about that.
That's fair.
I don't want my boss.
I thought that was a risk. I had to go for it.
I know.
You've been amazing. And thank you so much for spending so much time talking to us.
You're welcome. This was awesome. I hope I didn't say too much. I probably
No one says more than Brian.
Okay. What?
Where can people find you and your work in Society of Grownups?
So Society of Grownups is societyofgrownups.com, and our Twitter is at Society Grownups. Doesn't have an oven. And I'm at Christy T on Twitter. And hopefully I'll have my website updated, which is boycottlettuce.com.
Boycott Lettuce.
Wait, can you explain that one real quick?
So there's this poster. So like I discovered that the Black Panthers had this amazing like art director that did all of their propaganda posters. And so I found that on a website. There was a website with all of the posters like for like 20 years, and it went over like all the process of the collaging and photo collaging, and the work is amazing. And one of the posters, one of the covers of one of the magazines was Boycott Lettuce. It was about a farm boycott in California. I want to say in the 1920s, and there was this Mexican rights group that led it, and the signs on the cover said Boycott Lettuce. And I thought that was like an interesting like way of resistance. And so I just jacked it.
I love that. I love that. Boycottlettuce.com.
That's super memorable too. Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah. Well, Christy, thank you again. It's been awesome having you on. I'm excited to push this episode live.
Yeah, thank you, Christy.
Thank you.